Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vijay Prashad, Professor and Director of International Studies at Trinity College, who expresses concern over the precedent set in the U.S.-NATO military intervention in Libya's anti-Gaddafi revolution. Ricky Ott, a marine toxicologist, activist, author, and former commercial fisher, who discusses the human and environmental impacts of fossil fuel use and outlines her hope for a fossil fuel-free future. And Tom Hayden, former California legislator, activist, and a founder of Students for a Democratic Society, who assesses the power of the growing Occupy Wall Street movement nationwide. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The number of deaths from malaria, a disease that annually kills tens of thousands of children in Africa and Southeast Asia, fell by 20% in the last decade, according to the World Health Organization. Over the next decade, public health experts project that one-third of all countries currently suffering from malaria can eradicate the disease. According to the WHO, over 780,000 people died from malaria in 2009, mostly children under five, in sub-Saharan Africa. In the worst-affected African countries, action against malaria accounts for 40% of all public health spending and nearly half of all hospital admissions. Over the last decade, spending to fight malaria has risen tenfold, with major funding coming from the Gates Foundation and the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Most funding went to pay for malaria bed nets, drugs, and tests that saved the lives of 1.1 million Africans. Medical researchers report significant progress in developing an effective malaria vaccine. The experimental vaccine, known as RTS-S, is made by GlaxoSmithKline, and the nonprofit PATH Malaria Vaccine Initiative is coordinating the trial studies. With 25 years of research invested, the vaccine faces three more years of trials before it can be widely used. Questions have been raised about who will pay to distribute the vaccine in some of the world's poorest nations. Since the Great Recession began in 2008, the average American has lost $1,300 in earning power. Sagging incomes have also fueled anger at the political and economic elite, as seen in the emerging Occupy Wall Street movement. Persistent 9% unemployment with few job prospects has become a fact of life. According to the Christian Science Monitor, inflation-adjusted incomes fell 9.8% since 2008, while the value of housing has fallen 22% since the peak in 2007. The stock market, as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, is still 5% below the market peak in 1999. Lower-skilled and less educated Americans have been hurt the most by the Great Recession and stagnant recovery. These workers are more likely to be affected by outsourcing of factory jobs to emerging economies like China and India. Economist Joel Naroff commented, "It appears large parts of the workforce have moved permanently into lower-paying positions. The economy can't grow at 4% when the middle class is becoming the lower middle class." With a surge of customs enforcement officers deployed to the U.S.-Mexican border, opportunity abounded for corruption and dirty deals by U.S. border agents. According to the Los Angeles Times, 132 customs agents have been indicted or convicted for corruption since 2004. The number of internal agency investigations has tripled over the last 5 years. Currently, there are over 24,000 customs agents working along the border with Mexico, with half of those agents hired since 2006. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which oversees immigration and customs agents, was warned about the possibility of widespread corruption in rushing to hire new agents with limited background checks. Customs agent Luis Alarid was hired in 2007 despite having family ties to smugglers and $30,000 in credit card debt. Shortly after starting as an agent, he informed smugglers in Tijuana about which entry point he was patrolling. In 4 months, Alarid pocketed over $200,000 paid by smugglers. Alarid is now serving a 7-year term for corruption in a federal prison. Veteran customs agents say the rising corruption is in part the result of political pressure on Washington to hire thousands of agents without adequate funding in place for thorough background checks, pressure exerted by border states where anti-immigrant sentiment is high. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Shaky video recorded the gruesome end of Libyan dictator Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's life on October 20th as he tried to escape his embattled hometown of Sirte in a car convoy that was hit by a NATO airstrike. An apparently wounded Gaddafi ran from his car and sought refuge in a drainage pipe. When rebels captured him, he was abused, humiliated, and executed with a gunshot to the head. The grisly images distributed on the internet were soon seen by millions around the world. Before being buried in an unmarked grave, Gaddafi's body and that of his son, Mutasim, were transported to the city of Misrata, where they were put on public display in a warehouse cold storage locker. The loose coalition of rebels that overthrew the Gaddafi regime, under pressure from the international community, announced they would conduct an investigation into Gaddafi's murder. But human rights organizations such as Amnesty International have declared that the rebels have not adequately responded to a growing pattern of unchecked violence by their forces during the course of their 8-month revolution. In fact, a massacre of unknown proportions thought to be perpetrated by anti-Gaddafi militias was discovered at Sirte's Mahari Hotel in the days after the city fell to rebel control. Your reporter spoke with Vijay Prashad, professor and director of international studies at Trinity College, who expresses concern over the precedent set in the U.S.-NATO military intervention in Libya and the future of the oil-rich African nation.
Firstly, one should say that this is a very disquieting end to this war. The war was fought on the grounds that the Gaddafi regime was going to basically circumvent the Geneva Conventions and perpetuate some kind of massacre either in Misrata or in Benghazi. And based on press reports, the United Nations General Secretary, Ban Ki-moon, and particularly the head of the International Criminal Court, the lead prosecutor, Mr. Moreno Ocampo, began to talk about genocide. They were joined by Navi Pillay at the UN Human Rights Office. So this chorus began saying that there needs to be some kind of intervention to prevent a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And to that end, the United Nations Security Council passed Resolution 1973. Now, what's disquieting is that the war seems to have ended by doing precisely what it was set up to prevent, because the war parameters provided by the Security Council were simply that any measures were allowed that would enable the protection of civilians. The actual UN resolution does not say anything about regime change, nor does it actually give the member states power to utilize all force to remove a regime. You know, there is not only the killing of Mr. Gaddafi, but also the removal of his regime was outside the bounds of the UN mandate. But in this case, the United States and NATO have consistently utilized military force from the sky to do much more than simply protect civilians, several times attempting to kill Mr. Gaddafi, including firing at his compound in Tripoli at least twice.
Vijay, here in the United States, Colonel Gaddafi and his death, there's very little sympathy for him and his regime crumbling. And, of course, the Obama administration is patting itself on the back for what they termed as leading from behind, using air power to help rebels on the ground overthrow this regime accused of terrorism, killing Americans, the downing of the Lockerbie airliner. Beyond the many reasons to find Gaddafi and his regime anathema, what is at stake in terms of international law that you really want to get at the heart of with how this operation was managed by the United States and NATO?
Well, I mean, you know, if we take international law seriously, then we have to take the various conventions and see if those conventions have found their way into life. You know, you have decided, let us go and, you know, unseat somebody from power. They are, in whatever way, because they are parties at the United Nations, they are a legitimate regime. So you have said that there is an uprising ongoing, and people are going to be harmed. Therefore, I will now intervene on behalf of those people against a leader I don't like. This is the scenario, essentially, if you break it down, that was there in Libya. The United States, NATO, particularly the French, the Qataris and others have disliked Gaddafi for a long time. largely on personal grounds, because if you'd like, we can go into how Gaddafi actually was collaborating with them over the past 15 years. But at any rate, Gaddafi had to go, and you then pick up a small rebellion and say, this small rebellion at the time in February, which was gaining steam, you know, as every day went by, and say, we are going to come in and you. So what this does is this provides a serious moral hazard problem with interventionism. You know, what is to stop, say, somebody in Tibet beginning a rebellion in a small town somewhere, and as the Chinese army marches towards crushing the rebellion, they call for NATO support, because after all, grammatically, it is identical to what occurred in Libya. Or the similar kind of thing can happen in Kashmir. You know, if there's a rebellion breaks out, they will then say, why doesn't the United Nations intervene here? Indeed, this is exactly what is happening in Syria, where the Syrian opposition is saying every minute, why is there no intervention here? So if there is to be intervention, it has to be very, very much thought out. Is this a new policy for world affairs? If there is, well, let us have an international convention on humanitarian intervention. Let the General Assembly have a debate about what should be the parameters for humanitarian intervention. One cannot allow a world system where a few countries decide when to intervene and what the nature of the intervention should be. So what does the West gain from it? Well, they were already getting the oil, but now they gain the people who wanted to turn Libya into Dubai on the Mediterranean. These are people who have a much greater affinity to the West. You know, they would perhaps even welcome the creation of a U.S. base in Libya. They don't carry the baggage that Gaddafi carried, you know, rhetorical revolutionary stuff. All that stuff is now gone. Now you have essentially businessmen who are ready to do business.
That was Vijay Prashad, professor and director of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's the author of Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. Visit our Between the Lines website to find more perspectives on the Libyan conflict at btlonline.org. In the never-ending quest for harder-to-access fossil fuels, oil spills, gas explosions, and pipeline leaks are everyday occurrences. The impacts of the quest for oil on ecosystems, while not always fully understood, are easy to see. But the effect on human health is often harder to determine, and serious problems are often misdiagnosed or just dismissed out of hand. Ricky Ott is a marine toxicologist, activist, author, and former commercial fisher who experienced the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska firsthand. She spent years examining the continuing threats to sea life and humans from that 1989 disaster. After British Petroleum's massive Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010, she spent months helping local residents identify health consequences and demand help in getting medical treatment. Ott also spent time in Battle Creek, Michigan, after a tar sands pipeline ruptured in July 2010 and spilled 1 million gallons of tar sands oil into the Kalamazoo River watershed. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ott during the Connecting for Change Conference and East Coast Pioneers Gathering held in New Bedford, Massachusetts in October, where she was a keynote speaker. Here, Ott discusses the human impacts of fossil fuel use and outlines her hope for a fossil fuel-free future.
I think the best arguments for stopping all of our fossil fuel use is the human health impacts. This has been consistently covered up every time there's a spill or a disaster like in the Gulf. Oh, people have heat stroke, people are seasick, people have food poisoning. I've been down there again recently, just in October, and people still have the same symptoms that they had a year and a half ago. I'm sorry, but you don't get seasickness for a year and a half, or heat stroke for a year and a half. People are on multiple rounds of antibiotics, or have been, with absolutely no change in their symptoms. This is because it's not a biological causation. It's chemical causation. And what I've been seeing is the petrochemical industry and, unfortunately, the insurance company, which is influenced heavily by these big corporations, they don't want to acknowledge that oil makes people sick, very, very sick. And so they've covered it up. And medical doctors in the Gulf now are intentionally or very misinformedly, let me put it that way, diagnosing people with heat stroke and whatnot, because they know that if they put chemical illness, they will not get paid. The insurance company will not pay them. So there's all kinds of levels of this going on. We see this with the tar sands. I was shocked when I went to Battle Creek, Michigan in August. So it was about a year after the Enbridge pipeline spill. I was shocked that people were exactly as sick as they were in the Gulf with all the same symptoms. And I realized that I had hardly heard anything about this in the news. And then I realized, oh, that's because it's a political game. Our nation at the highest level has no exit strategy off of oil or fossil fuels. Forget natural gas as a bridge. The fracking is killing people. It's poisoning water, irreversibly damaging precious water to the point where it will be toxic for generations. We cannot afford these environmental costs. We cannot afford the human health costs of pursuing this addiction to fossil fuels until the last drop is gone. We have to get off of it. And what that's going to take, since our federal government has no imagination space to do this, completely been hijacked by the corporations, is it's going to take the people doing exactly what they're doing now, rising up and saying enough and becoming aware of the huge costs to human health and the environment and saying no. No bridge with natural gas. No such thing as clean coal. Nuclear is a disaster waiting to happen. We need to seriously invest in clean, green, safe energies. I don't even call them alternative. I call them energy options. This is all doable. We can do it now, and we need to do it.
Now, if we did it now, that would, I mean, they say, you know, we can do it. There's just, we lack the political will. But it would also mean, I think, people would have to use less energy, which wouldn't necessarily be a terrible burden based on how much we use now. But is that true? Don't you think that's true?
I think part of the equation is we've been wasting an incredible amount of energy. And if we just simply cut back on what, I don't even think people are aware of how much we really are wasting. So there's a combination of we're using more than we need right now. And then there is the real fact that we as Americans have been living sort of high on the hog. And it's going to take restructuring our lifestyles. I think that can be done in a way that actually makes our living better, where we'll have more free time, more quality time with our families. So that's sort of the pioneer's dream. But I'm seeing this dream in transition towns and other communities across the U.S., sustainable Seattle, dreaming New Mexico. I mean, there are states and communities working towards this end of how could we be happier with less stuff. And you know what? It's real. I mean, the communities that are trying this are finding it's much more satisfying than the way we live now. So I'm actually looking at being really excited about what's around the corner in terms of realizing more of our full potential as human beings with less energy.
You said in your talk that 95 to 100% of the hundreds of people from the Gulf whose blood was tested had traces of oil in their system and also evidence of the dispersants. That's shocking.
Okay. What happened when I was in the Gulf, literally by late June, July of 2010, people started asking me as I went back and forth across the Gulf, is there any way that I can prove that I'm feeling this way because of what happened in the Gulf, because of BP's disaster? And I said, yes, we need to take volatile organic solvent blood profiles. And people did that. They did it across the Gulf from Florida to Louisiana. And what was consistently found, whether they're two-year-olds, 80-year-olds, whether they just are a visitor down to the Gulf or whether they actually had a beach home on the Gulf, that the level of oil that is showing up in people's blood is in the upper 95th to 100 percentile of people nationwide. In other words, they have more oil in their blood than 95 to 100% of the rest of us in the nation. This is toxic. This is an emergency situation. And it is totally freaking people out down there. People are dying. People know people are dying. And people are struggling to get immediate triage for something that the federal government, most of the medical doctors in the Gulf, and BP are completely still denying at this point. I mean, it's an incredible situation. The people are not backing down, though.
That was marine toxicologist Ricky Ott. Her latest book on oil spill impacts is titled Not One Drop. Find more information on the campaign for a fossil fuel-free future on our website at btlonline.org. just over 5 weeks old, the new and growing Occupy Wall Street movement that began in New York's Zuccotti Park on September 17th has spread to hundreds of cities nationwide and across the world. Thousands of activists decrying corporate greed and political corruption have established encampments in parks, on the grounds of state capitals, city halls, and in the shadow of large financial institutions. Participants, many of them young, but of all ages and from all walks of life, have begun creating communities based on horizontal direct democracy, making their decisions about their political stands and local activities by consensus. Students, unions, and healthcare workers are among the groups that have made common cause with the new movement. But increasingly, these protesters, engaged by their very presence in direct action civil disobedience by gathering in public spaces without permits, are being targeted by police for eviction and arrest. On October 25th, police cleared out protesters from the Occupy Wall Street movement in Oakland, California, arresting 75. Philadelphia police recently arrested 15 activists at a protest in that city. And on October 23rd, Chicago police arrested 130 Occupy activists in Grant Park, the site of protests during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. It's not certain what the future holds for the Occupy Wall Street movement, but according to public opinion polls, they have substantial support from the American people, many who are angry about continuing high unemployment, record mortgage foreclosures, and the lack of accountability for the wealthy elite on Wall Street who crashed the economy. Your reporter spoke with Tom Hayden, a former California state senator, peace and civil rights activist, best known as a founder of Students for a Democratic Society. Here, Hayden assesses the power of the Occupy Wall Street movement from the perspective of a veteran political organizer who played a pivotal role in the anti-Vietnam War movement in the 1960s and 70s.
I'm not trying to be an advisor. My friend Keith Olbermann keeps asking me to be on because he wants to promote something I said. So let him promote it. God bless him. I'll tell you what I said, but it was a prediction, not a promotion. It was, you know, a prediction, and I think the prediction is proving to be incorrect, or certainly hasn't been carried out, that the time would come when the massive occupations would eventually be met with the tactics of arrest and removal by the police and by city authorities, and civil disobedience would occur, but that if it was on a grand scale, if you could conceive of the largest number of people in protest history agreeing to and committing to being peacefully arrested and refusing bail and demanding a jury trial of their peers, I think it would bring to an end the possibility of state coercion or police coercion of protest as a technique of control, and it would have huge effects on the image of Wall Street and the government, would have international repercussions, and it might force people to try to deal with the, you know, the actual problems instead of the corollary issues of law and order. But I don't see that happening yet. I sense there's tension everywhere. I was in a couple of these places very, very briefly, and the city authorities seem to have pulled back from any decision to bring in the police. And I think that that is because of public opinion, because of the media. And it doesn't mean that there won't be civil disobedience or arrest. There have been probably a couple of thousand. Denver, New York, you know what I'm talking about. But those seem to be isolated cases based on local crises rather than a national consensus on one side or the other to bring it to a head around, police coercion and arrests and civil disobedience. That day may come, but I'm certainly open to other predictions as to where it might go. Since it was born unexpectedly, its growth should be assumed to be unexpected as well, no?
Certainly true. The media has focused a lot on the lack of specific demands, but it seems to be
a genius move on the part of people organizing this to form a community in Zuccotti Park in New York City where this began, and that has sort of translated around the country, where people are forming communities of support and using direct democracy, horizontal democracy, to figure out where this movement goes next. How do you see that as a tactic, and just in terms of building the movement to even larger numbers before you get specific with your demand list?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think if you're trying to force your issues onto the national agenda, demands will become important, and specific proposals like the Robin Hood tax on financial transactions will become important. But it's not there yet. And if people sat around in circles, sat around in affinity groups, they might be paralyzed or divided by trying to come up with the three top demands. This is not Dave Letterman's show. Everybody knows it's about two things, the Wall Street economic crisis and the massive unemployment, and the utter failure of the institutions, financial, corporate, and political, to be able to respond to the crisis in a way that's positive. And so I would say that these are, you know, kind of outliers of resistance or signs of resistance, an encampment to draw attention to the shameful state of things. And what comes next is anybody's guess, but I think it will evolve into I think it will evolve into positive direction and be with us in a beneficial way, I hope, through the 2012 election at least.
That was Tom Hayden, a former California state senator, longtime peace and civil rights activist, best known as a founder of Students for a Democratic Society. Read Tom Hayden's recent article on the Occupy Wall Street movement and find other related links on our website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.